Support for this program comes from Jazz on the Tube, the Internet's largest collection of free streamable classic jazz videos. From Miles Davis to Louis Armstrong, from Thelonious Monk to Duke Ellington, you'll find it all on jazzonthetube.com. Start your free subscription today.
Hi, and welcome to Jazz Talk, a Jazz on the Tube podcast. My name is Ken McCarthy, and this is where we talk with people who are doing important work that supports and illuminates the music we love. The writers, the scholars, the educators, the filmmakers, the producers, and more. And we're talking today with the author of New Orleans Remix, Jack Sullivan. Welcome, Jack.
Thank you so much, Ken.
You know, as lovers of this music, we can't talk enough about New Orleans, learn enough about New Orleans, discover enough about New Orleans. It is a deep and rich place, and every time a great book comes out about the subject, I make it my business to get it and read it, and I'm so glad, Jack, that we could have you talk about this book. It's really, for people that don't know it yet, it is a very substantial book. This is something that you can really chew on for a long, long time. I want to make just two comments before we start about New Orleans. One, if you're a jazz fan, you somehow have to get yourself to New Orleans. You just have to do it. Just once. Right? And I say this as a New Yorker, chauvinistic New Yorker who grew up in the New York area, who just assumed that New York was the beginning, middle, and end of jazz, and how important could New Orleans be? And so when I finally got myself to New Orleans way too late in life, but at least I got myself there, I discovered that, wow, this is music heaven. And since then, I've been an advocate for everybody to get there. There's a few things of New Orleans history that people aren't aware of. And one of the things is that it's had such a profound creative impact on musicians that we all know and love, and we're not even aware of it. For example, a lot of people just aren't aware that Lester Young, who's one of the key persons in jazz, I think if you take Lester Young out of the equation, a whole bunch of the jazz edifice collapses. He was such an essential artist. Well, he spent his formative years in the New Orleans, Algiers area. Ray Charles. Everybody loves Ray Charles. Well, Ray Charles went through an incredible creative transformation after his time in New Orleans. And even Ornette Coleman, who everybody associates with the avant-garde, rightly so. Ornette was, in 1949, he ran into some trouble on the road. He was stranded. And Melvin Lasky, trumpet player and a member of the Lasky musical family, invited him to come and stay in the Lower Nine. And he was there for many months. And he told me personally that it was playing in the churches of New Orleans, in the church music of New Orleans, that gave him the feeling that he could really play for free and get away with it. So this is such a profound place. So we're so fortunate to have you, Jack, to talk about New Orleans. Let's talk about the myth and the reality. Now, the textbook myth is that New Orleans jazz started in New Orleans and it went up the Mississippi River, and that's the origin of jazz, and that New Orleans is truly a special place. Now, other people say, well, hey, look, there was great music going on all over the United States, and it's wrong to oversimplify the jazz story with that. What's your comments on that, President? What place for us to start?
Well, I think that there's some myths happen to be true, and this one may not be completely true, but it's fundamentally true. And certainly all the musicians interviewed, and I interviewed many, many musicians for this book, they certainly believe it's true. And one of the most convincing exponents of that myth is John Batiste, who, of course, plays for the Colbert Show now. But I, when I speak with him, he's in New York, as I am most of the time, but he's in New Orleans a lot, too, and he's from New Orleans. And he says it's because New Orleans was a port city, and there was a confluence of so many different kinds of ethnicities there, A, and B, there was a need for a new kind of dance music in the 1890s to finally do something besides waltzes and polkas, and young people were demanding some new dance forms, and they didn't want different dances for Irish people, different dances for Italians, Albanians, all the different types of music, and that jazz really started out as a kind of a demand for a new style, a new kind of hot dance music. And it happened in New Orleans first because there were so many people there from so many different places. Kind of the way it is now, John points out, with the internet. There was no internet, but it was that kind of thing. And of course it spread other places in kind of random ways. There's nothing linear about it. And I think one of the things I try to point out in the book is that there's nothing linear about the origins of jazz. But there's something magical about New Orleans that many of the musicians talk about. The clarinetist Michael White is very eloquent on this subject. Just about anybody you talk to, Alan Toussaint, they all say there's a kind of magic that seems to kind of seep out of the streets, a kind of spirit of the ancestors. And I know that sounds silly and kind of pseudo-metaphysical, but if you're there, you know it's true. It's something palpable, and you just sense, you know, this myth has got to be true in some fundamental way. I know when I first went to New Orleans, it was in the early 80s. My brother lives in Lafayette, Louisiana, and I went to his wedding, and I'd been hearing a lot of jazz in New York because I live in New York, and I went to Preservation Hall because I didn't know where else to go. And in those days, it was really hard to find another place to go. And it was really a life-changing experience for me because I just never had heard anything like that. I'd heard a kind of parody of it in New York, actually. Is it kind of a Xerox copy of it? But that's when I first got this idea that what I hear in New York is kind of graduate school jazz, as I call it. And in New Orleans, from that very first moment in the hall, there was a kind of electricity and realness and exuberance to it. Plus, everybody was playing something different. It was completely polyphonic. I didn't even know that was possible. It was really, really what we now call ensemble music. All those things just kind of blew my mind. And that's when I started coming down and coming down and coming down and eventually decided to write this book.
Mm-hmm. One of my transformative experiences in New Orleans was hearing the Tremé Brass Band, and yes, it just, you know, and I'm a guy that, you know, Cecil Taylor once rehearsed all day in the studio where I work. I used to hang out at Ornette's loft on the Bowery, and so I've heard some music, and those guys just blew me away.
I remember last week I was in New Orleans promoting the book, and mainly just to go to Jazz Fest, and Tremé was playing in DBA, which is one of the really great clubs I'd like to talk about. Mm-hmm. And Shamar Allen, before the night was over, had every single person in that place dancing. And if they didn't dance, he would humiliate them until, you know, in a nice way, until they got out on the floor and did a few moves. Didn't matter if they were good moves or not. And that's the other thing about New Orleans music that I just didn't know, and that is if it's not danceable, they have a profound indifference to it. And musicians tell me again and again, if it's not dancing, if people aren't dancing, we're not happy. And
this is
a kind of participatory quality to it that you just don't find in New York. You just have to go there to experience it.
This is a critical point, and let's talk about this. You know, jazz, as you pointed out earlier, started out as a social music, a party music, and entertainment music. And I completely understand why certain musicians like Charlie Parker and Dizzy Gillespie and others said, hey, you know, our music is serious too, and we'd like to get the same level of attention and respect that a European classical musician gets. I totally get that. And there's room for that, and there's a place for that. But I think jazz imperils itself when it cuts itself off from the social, party, entertainment, hey, we're all together to have a good time element. It's not trivializing thing. It's not, oh, you know, we're just, oh, shucks, we're just entertainers. It's art and social awareness or consciousness or whatever you want to call it. Can you talk a little bit about that? You've already sort of mentioned the essence of it, which is that in New Orleans, the purpose of music is to bring the group together, the crowd together, for a good time.
Well, one thing that was liberating about writing this book is I usually write about classical music. Most of the writing I do, I mean, I'm actually an English professor, so all uh-huh. of this is relatively new to me. But most of the writing about music I do is I write program notes for Carnegie Hall and for the Metropolitan Opera. And so it was just so liberating for me to be able to use words like vibe and cool instead of words like overture and coda, and to kind of get into the feeling of something very, very different where they don't make a distinction between art and entertainment. There's no such distinction, and before Wagner, there was no such distinction in opera either.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very possible to party and be a very serious partier. Let's put it that way. And I hear groups all the time who are somebody like Aurora Neilan, the great clarinetist saxophonist in New Orleans. She's a very serious artist. But when she plays with the Royal Roses, her group, everybody is dancing.
Mm-hmm.
And she's playing some very complex chord changes. The same with somebody like Wendell Brunius, who was displaced for 7 years after Hurricane Katrina, and he came back to New Orleans because he said ultimately the only place that really respects melody, as he put it, is this town. And so I just had to come back here. There's no contradiction between lyricism and complexity any more than there's a contradiction between serious art music and partying, wild, crazy music. And as I say, in Preservation Hall in 1980, when I first heard this music, that became clear to me because this was very tight polyphonic music, but there was something very joyous and partying about it at the same time. And I think you have those two in perfect balance, so you can't hear where one begins and the other ends. And when the music is imported as it needs to be, it doesn't quite have that combination. Like if you hear, I heard the Rebirth Brass Band at Brooklyn Bowl recently, and it was a perfectly okay show, but when you hear the Rebirth Brass Band at the Maple Leaf in New Orleans, it's mind-blowing every single time, and it's because the audience interacts with the music. It's because, as Phil Fraser, who's the leader of the band, says, in New Orleans, the attitude is, we know how good you is, now show us how good you is. And they know
wow.
the repertory, and there's a kind of interaction. And people are very respectful and profoundly attentive, and yet they're also having a good time.
You know, that
it's fascinating. You have to be there to experience it.
There is a repertory, and it is known by New Orleanians and New Orleans fans who make frequent visits. There's a body of music that people know. And in fact, like New York,
yes.
there's a ton of songs about New Orleans. So it's very
yes.
interesting to be in New Orleans, hearing musicians singing about New Orleans,
yes.
which is, by the way, is not unlike being in Havana. So many of the songs in Havana, when you break down the lyrics, it's like, hey, here we are singing this great music. We love it. We're dancing hard. We're having a good time. I mean, those are literally the lyrics. And when you learn Spanish and you finally realize what they're saying, you're like, oh, wow, this is very
yes.
straight up.
And, of course, a lot of the great stuff that's happening now in New Orleans is Latin. And the kind of the progenitor of so much of this music, Louis Moreau Gottschalk, who was really the great sort of the first pop star in America, he played in Latin America, in Cuba, and then of course there are all these Haitians who migrated to New Orleans, and so you really have Cuba in New Orleans too,
mm-hmm.
and it's very popular just now, especially.
Yeah, and we're all hoping that in the long arc of history, that connection between Havana and New Orleans will be restored. There was a huge amount of ship traffic and trade between those two cities, and it all came to a crashing halt, of course, in the early 60s. But there's a great thing from Earl Palmer, the great drummer Earl Palmer,
yeah.
in his biography, talks about sneaking on a ship and in New Orleans and getting to Havana and just raving about the music and the scene. And there was a lot of cross-pollination and communication between those cities for a long time. If you know, for instance, when you walk through French Quarter, you'll see these plaques that say, you know, this street used to be called, you know, and they give the Spanish name.
Yes.
So the city was literally administered via Havana for about 40 years, I'd say. Hey, I have a question. Since you're an opera guy, I mean, now it makes sense because one of the great chapters in this book, which we're going to talk about in a bit, is about opera and New Orleans and jazz and how they all fit together. But I've always heard that in the old days, pre-Wagner, that the operas were a lot more boisterous. People would, you know, during the, I don't know, what do they call the thing where people aren't singing, but they're kind of talking, they're sing-songing, you know, they're talking, but there's not necessarily a musical piece going on.
Yes, yeah, so the recitatif is what the technical term is.
Okay, so during the recitatif, people wouldn't really pay attention. They'd be chatting with each other. They'd be buying fruit from the vendor who was walking up and down the aisle. But then when the arias came, then everybody would stop and really pay attention. And I'm half Italian, and apparently one of my relatives, when he went to the opera, he would sing along with the arias, and it was okay. Nobody had a problem with people in the audience humming or singing, so opera now is a pretty buttoned up experience. But could you confirm or deny that opera was not that way then?
We know from many accounts that it was spilling out in the streets the way we think of as jazz in New Orleans now, like Frenchman Street now. Opera was supposedly very much like that. And some of the earliest impressions that Louis Armstrong gives us in his memoirs and his interviews is from Italian opera. And we know that he warmed up on Italian opera. We know that he loved Petrozzini and Caruso and all those great singers, and that it was an important part of his art. And he tried to he wanted his horn to sound like an opera singer. And there's a certain lyricism, the kind of thing I was indicating with the trumpeter Wendell Brunius, the kind of open embrace of melody that really comes from opera in New Orleans. New Orleans was the great opera center of the New World. It wasn't New York, and in fact, many of the so-called American premieres of important works really premiered in New Orleans, which had two huge opera companies and also entertained touring opera companies for hundreds of years, and so I think that's just in the blood. And opera people tell me that New Orleans is a good place to live because it's good for your voice, because of the laid backness of the whole ambiance is so laid back. And so I interviewed people who told me that in the old days people in the pit would train some of the early jazz players, and then in turn they would return the favor by teaching those guys to swing. So there was a lot of interplay from the very beginning between the two forms. And
I also imagine
a lot of people don't seem to know that, but it's really an important part of history. John Butte, who's one of the great singers in New Orleans in the current scene, says that opera is jazz's grandma, is the way he puts it.
Boy, that's profound, and that really is new information for a lot of people. We run a website where we put out a video of the day, a jazz video of the day. And I remember a couple of years ago, I heard this opera piece and I said, guys, this isn't jazz, but I just have to play it because the melody is so perfect. And so when I first learned that Louis Armstrong was an opera fan, which I only learned recently, in fact, I learned it last week. And then when I opened your book and so talking about New Orleans Remix, and we are talking here with Jack Sullivan, the author of New Orleans Remix, you have an entire chapter dedicated to the ins and outs of this New Orleans jazz opera connection. Now, I imagine that Creole musicians, I could be wrong, but Creole musicians would possibly have been employed in these opera houses as in the pit. Yes,
indeed. And, you know, and you can see, if you look at the early jazz players, that it's just such a mixed bag. I mean, you have Albanians, you know, you have Sicilians, you of course have African Americans, and that was true, you know, in both in every kind of music. And that's one of the reasons why, I mean, Barry Martin, who came to New Orleans in 1960, he's one of the most senior players there now. He's a drummer, and you know, he says that the way he put it was that we just toss around all these different influences all the time, and we don't get hung up on who's playing in which genre. We just play whatever people want to hear. And there's actually a really great opera singer, Antonio Diel, D-I-E-L. He was an opera singer on the West Coast, and he fell in love with jazz. And to the consternation of his music teachers, he came to New Orleans and is now a jazz singer.
Uh-huh.
And he had this huge operatic voice, and he said that his opera training actually helped him because he said a lot of jazz is acting, you know, your stage presence. And he said mm-hmm. that opera training helped with that as well. And so now he's become a real presence. He has his own band. He sings a lot of Gershwin. He sings a lot of crossover things, but he also sings a lot of jazz that he himself has composed. And the cross currents are still very much there, is what I'm saying.
Mm. Hey, let's talk about something that is uniquely New Orleans. There are many things that are uniquely New Orleans, but one of them is the Mardi Gras Indian tradition. This is something I have to confess I had absolutely no awareness of until I got to New Orleans, and then I began to realize, wow, this is a really deep and old tradition, possibly going back all the way to Congo Square. I don't know that anybody's been able to really work that out, but it certainly is an old tradition. It precedes recorded music, that's for sure. Tell us, to people that aren't aware of this Mardi Gras Indian tradition, what is it? What's it all about, and what are they doing musically?
Well, it originally was about, it's about black people dressing up as Native Americans, and it's an homage to Native Americans would help hide slaves, runaway slaves. And this, as you say, goes back very, very far. Some people say before the Congo Square era. And it's called masking. And every year at Mardi Gras, you'll have a parade of so-called Mardi Gras Indians who will have these just fantastically elaborate costumes that they work on literally all year. The day after Mardi Gras, they start sewing for the next one. And you can see a very accurate depiction of it in this great show called Treme on HBO that didn't have a whole lot of episodes, but it really is true to everybody I talked to in New Orleans who's a Mardi Gras Indian says this is this show really does depict something that no other commercial show has ever depicted. But one of the things that happened when I was writing the book was that I discovered certain things that really started changing since the 1990s. And one of those things was the presence and the visibility of the Mardi Gras Indians. They were pretty much in secret, pretty much you would never see them except on Mardi Gras Day. And now they play a great deal all through the year in various clubs. They just come into the clubs in costume, and they will play the original music for the Mardi Gras Indians was percussion music, and that fused with funk in the early late 60s, early 70s, with songs like Big Chief and Ico Ico, and became a whole new kind of music. And now you see the Mardi Gras Indians a great deal, and I would recommend people who really want to experience this go down on St. Joseph's Day. You have to look it up. Just look it up online. You'll see it's different. It's in March, but you can see the Mardi Gras Indians parade, and you can parade with them. They're very open to that on St. Joseph's Day, and it's an amazing experience. But it's both a music, and it's also a kind of a spectacle, a visual spectacle. It's really wonderful, and there's nothing else like it. As you say, it goes back very far.
Yeah, the union or the partnership, the collaboration between African Americans and Native Americans is something that they celebrate through that.
Yes.
And it really cuts both ways. On the one hand, if an African American could escape out into the countryside, he could possibly find Native Americans to live with and who would shelter him. Now, late on, but it also worked the other way. And it was explained to me this way, that if you were an African American in the South, you ran the risk of being captured and put into slavery. If you were a Native American in the South, you just, or anywhere in the country for that matter, you ran the risk of being killed on the spot.
Yes.
So it's a very important historical collaboration to our nation's soul, and celebrated by these groups. And they have their own music, their own chants, their own rhythms. They practice every week. And then they create these, as you pointed out, these incredibly elaborate costumes, which they only wear occasionally, and then the tradition is to disassemble them. You don't wear them the next year. You have to have a completely new suit the following year, and they're hand stitched. There's no sewing machines allowed.
There's actually a Mardi Gras Indian. They call it a museum, but it's really more than a museum. But it's in just into the Treme off North Rampart on Claiborne Street that you can go to. You have to kind of search for it, but it's there. And there's an older guy there who will give you a tour and explain everything and show you many, many costumes. And it's something that's not usually in the tourist books, but it's worth seeking out.
Yeah, one of the projects I'm working on, there's a number of small museums in New Orleans. I think you're referring to the Backstreet Museum.
That's it. Mm-hmm.
Yep. And it's in a former funeral home right near St. Augustine Church, St. Andrew's Church, right north of Rampart.
Yeah.
Also, Donald Harrison, who is a great jazz man, but also an Indian chief, Mardi Gras Indian chief, his family has a museum. There's also the Petit Jazz Museum. I think that's what it's called, Petit Treme Jazz Museum. It's just one room, but it has amazing things in it. And then there's the Great House of Dance and Feathers in the Lower Nine. And I would love, maybe one of your students could do this as a project. I would love someone just to make up a brochure that shows all of these little museums in one document that each museum could share with their guests. In other words, hey, if you go to the House of Dance and Feathers, make sure you go to the Backstreet Museum. And if you're at the Backstreet Museum, make sure you go to the Harrison Family Museum, and
people
so on.
People should also go to... at the Old Mint on just off Decatur Street, the Jazz Museum, where I actually spoke on the book last week. And there's just so many fabulous new things there. There's a brand new room on female jazz greats in New Orleans, and including contemporary ones. And that's one of the things that I noticed changing when I started writing this book, the incredible number of female artists that started both migrating to New Orleans, like this wonderful trombonist, Haruka Kikuchi, who's a trombonist for Kermit Ruffin's Barbecue Swingers now. And his keyboard player is actually Asian. The influx of Asians and female performers on horns, which is kind of a new thing. That's something that's just radically changed the whole vibe there. There's a sensational brass band called the Pinettes, that whenever I go to New Orleans, I go to hear them. They're out in the 7th Ward at a very hard-to-find place called Bullet's Lounge. But they're there every Friday night, and they put on a show that just has a completely different vibe because it's female and because they do lots of singing, unlike lots of the other brass bands. And so they sing as much as they play, and it's an amazing thing. But it's one of the things that's changed that I tried to note in the book, that I could sort of see changing every year I went down. There were more brass bands. There were really just a few prominent ones in 1989, 1990, when I first started going down regularly. And by the mid-90s, the trumpet player Leroy Jones told me, he said, "Jack, there's so many brass bands now, I cannot keep track of them anymore."
Mm.
And now it's even more that way. And then this incredible infusion of female players. There's a great band called the Shotgun Jazz Band with Marla Dixon on trumpet. And it's typical. And Marla's from Canada. Her husband, who plays banjo, is, I believe, from Alabama. For a while, Haruka Kikuchi was her trombone player. They're all from different places. They're all from different places, and that's what's happening now. There's a huge migration of new people in New Orleans on the current scene, and it's upsetting to some of the senior players that I interviewed. They feel they're being threatened by it, displaced by it. These people don't really know our traditions. They're not respectful of our traditions. But then there are other musicians I interviewed, like John Boutte and Alan Toussaint, who said, "Look, this is what the city is about. It's what it's always been about. It's always about new people coming in and adopting the culture and making it their own and then creating a remix," which is why I call the book New Orleans Remix. So there's real controversy about that. But there's no question in my mind that New Orleans is about change. It's change that's layered on top of something very old. Or as they would put it, they would just say it's all in the gumbo. That's their favorite metaphor. You know, in the gumbo, you don't throw anything out. You just put new things in.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's the way they prefer to see it.
And this all points to the fact that it's unspoken, but it's maybe the essential fact. New Orleans is a really musician-friendly city.
Yes.
If you're a young guy or girl and you want to get some chops and you want to play a lot, I don't think there's a better place to go than New Orleans to get that experience.
Yes, and everybody's welcomed. There are many players like the Shotgun Jazz Band. It has a regular gig now at Maison and the Spotted Cat, but they started out on Royal Street, just playing on the street. And they eventually got a few gigs, which led to other things. And I don't know of any other town that's quite like that, that has that kind of welcoming, what you're talking about now, welcomes music and musicians.
And then behind the scenes in people's houses, there's music going on all the time. So if you can play, and you can play well with others, you will make musical friends in New Orleans fast. Hey, let's talk about the practicalities of traveling to New Orleans. And again, I think I know you agree, and I just want to straight state this. And by the way, we're talking with Jack Sullivan about his book New Orleans Remix. If you love this music, somehow by hook or crook, you must get yourself to New Orleans at least once. And then once you go once, you may find yourself hooked. So be prepared. You know, we're conducting this interview in 2018, which is a different time than 2008, which is a different time than 1998, and a different time than 1988. What's your impression on New Orleans now? What would you recommend for someone visiting New Orleans in this era? You've already mentioned a lot of great clubs, and by the way, you mentioned some that I never heard of. So thank you very much. And by the way, that's a big part of New Orleans. It's multi-layered.
Yeah.
And I have never, at some point, I realized, wow, I'm never going to get to the bottom of this place. You know, in other words, you
right.
think you know something, you think, oh, I'm in now, I get it, and then you discover, oh no, there's another layer. beneath
yeah.
that, and on it goes. But for somebody that's coming for a couple of days or a week, what would your recommendations be about how to navigate the city and what to see and what to make sure they do not miss?
Well, of course, I would first say, please buy my book.
Yes.
Because then it will tell you a lot of navigational things that you're talking about. And I would, there are a couple things that are very stable that I talk about in the book. And one is be sure to go to the Maple Leaf Bar on Tuesday night and hear the Rebirth Brass Band. There's nothing like it. It's one of the few stable things in the glorious anarchy of New Orleans music. It's been going since the 80s. It draws a huge crowd. It's physically uncomfortable, but it's worth it. The last time I went there at 1 a.m., the Red Hot Chili Peppers showed up. They just simply showed up and jumped mm-hmm. up on the stage and did a gig with the Rebirth Brass Band.
Mm.
And I'd never heard anything like that, and you would only hear that in New Orleans. You talk about mm-hmm. a mashup. I mean, that was an unbelievably electrifying experience. But it's always that way. Tuesday night, I would say go there. It's past Tulane. It's a Uber situation, basically, but it's not hard to get to.
And I think you make. Can I just say something? Because you said something really important. Don't expect comfort at
no.
the Maple Leaf Lounge.
Oh my God, no.
But you will
forget about how uncomfortable you are.
Right, but you will. And we're talking about the fact there's no chair. If my memory is, you're basically on your feet the whole time. It's
yes.
not the prettiest room you've ever seen, but it's safe. You're not. You don't have to worry about your safety. Well, let me put it
no,
this way.
Exactly.
In every city in the world, you have to have your radar up, and New Orleans is no different. There's no city in the world where you can afford to be a fool wandering around intoxicated late at night by yourself. So, you know, with that as a warning, you know, just have your radar on. It's a big city, and it's
yeah.
like old cities.
Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, and then don't miss on Thursday nights at a wonderful place called Rockin' Bowl. They always have really spectacular Zydeco music, which is not native to New Orleans. It's really from Southwest Louisiana, especially Lafayette. But it's in the Rockin' Bowl every Thursday night, and it's now other places too. So it kind of has come to New Orleans, and that's a really great dance experience. The other one I was just mentioning is if you have the sense of adventure for it, to go to Bullets, which is in the 7th Ward. That's an Uber situation. And hear the Pinettes on Friday nights. And then, of course, there's Frenchman Street, where that's the new Bourbon. every kind of music in the world is there in New Orleans, and it's only about 2.5 blocks. It's an incredibly small mm-hmm. area, but there are certain things there that I think are pretty constant. I believe it's well, I'm going to stick my neck out now and just say don't, you know, I'm not going to stick my neck out, rather. Just go there and look in Offbeat magazine, look in their listings, which are online now, or WWOZ, great radio station. Either one, you'll see listings, and you can see which bands are in which clubs, and go to those. Another place that's very reliable is called Palm Court. It's mm-hmm. on Decatur Street. They only have music Wednesday through Sunday nights, but if you don't want to stand in that line in at Preservation Hall, which is a huge, huge line and very unpleasant, actually, I'm not saying don't go to the hall, go once or twice, but you can go to the Palm Court and hear pretty much the same musicians, and it's a nice sit-down place. It's easy to get a reservation. The cover is only $5, and Mark Bro, who is the leader of the Preservation Hall band, plays at Palm Court. This is just one example. Every Sunday night, I believe. It's either Sunday or Friday, and it rotates a bit. And every Wednesday night, you'll hear the spectacular old-style trumpet player Greg Stafford Wednesday nights at Palm Court with some really great blues singing by Topsy Chapman. She's there Wednesday night. And so that's another very reliable place, and that is very comfortable. So it's
you can
not
actually
comfortable, Ken.
they have actual chairs that you can sit on, and it's a restaurant. It's nice. Yeah,
they have wine glasses that are real wine glasses. They have yes, indeed. Yep. You seem to know it. Yeah.
Preservation Hall. I mean, yeah, right. You're going to wait online. It's just the reality. And be prepared, and you're going to sit on a bench.
Yeah.
But you can also get great music in a hollowed space.
And here's another one for you. Vaughn's on Thursday night. Vaughn's is. Again, it's an Uber situation. It's in the Bywater. It's a great example of a New Orleans institution, which is a local neighborhood bar that only has music once a week or twice a week. And that's what Vaughn's has been doing since the 80s. And everybody, all the locals know about it. And you get free food there. Cindy Wood, the owner, serves really wonderful soul food there Thursday nights. And I believe right now it's Corey Henry, who's a wonderful musician. His band plays there Thursday nights. And that, you know, that can change, but there's always music there Thursday nights.
Those are some really good tips. And the only thing I would add to that is definitely get Offbeat magazine. But I would also say get every free, and there's a bunch of them, free arts entertainment guide that they hand out. So there's other ones. I'm drawing a blank on the name, but you'll see them. They're all stacked together. And also get the Picayune and read everything because sometimes an amazing event will only be listed in one place.
Yes.
I went to, speaking of the great U.S. Mint, I went to an amazing all-day symposium on the old Dewdrop Inn. Yeah. Mind-boggling history, mind-boggling. And it was only listed two lines in the Picayune. Nobody else even mentioned it existed. So just get a big stack of stuff. And it, to me, it's like going to like the best music university conservatory on earth.
Yeah.
Between the lectures and the films and the performances and the parties and the outdoor events, it just goes on and on. Something that jumped out at me and we should mention is you've named a lot of musicians who may not have national or international resonance. In other words, we might have some real jazz hounds out there who say, well, I've never heard of that guy and I've never heard of her and I've never heard. Can we talk about the, and I don't mean this in a negative sense, but the insularity of the New Orleans scene?
Yes, it's one of the main purposes I had in writing this book was to just put that out there, just what you're talking about, Ken, that there are so many people who are almost famous. And they're famous in New Orleans, but they're not really famous outside of New Orleans. And they're incredible major talents. And a lot of them just don't like to travel. I mean, John Butte goes, he has a couple music festivals he goes to, and otherwise he stays put. Kermit Ruffins does not like to travel. These are hometown folks who really love the city. And Eddie Bow, the great pianist who passed on a few years ago, said he really doesn't think he performs as well outside the city. He really thinks there's a diminution of intensity in his piano playing, and he doesn't like playing outside the city. So so you have to kind of come to them, and it's just, you know, they're obviously, Dr. John has huge resonance all over the world. You say Dr. John, people know who he is. Wynton Marsalis, but Wynton Marsalis lives in New York now. So I think there are a lot more Leroy Joneses, who's one of the greatest trumpet players I've ever heard, and I'm astonished how many trumpeters I run into in New York who've never heard of Leroy at all. It's more likely you're going to be a Leroy Jones than you're going to be an Alan Toussaint. And, of course, Alan Toussaint, in the last years of his life, lived in New York. So, yes, I think that's another reason, just what you were saying. It's important to get down there to hear these extraordinary musicians.
Because there's really two parts to the life of a musician. There's the music and there's the business. And they're very different things. Mm-hmm. And not everybody is enthusiastic or even equipped to handle the business side. And the business side is touring. It's being in a different city every night for months on end. Yes. And that's just not a pleasant way to make a living. I mean, it may seem glamorous to us on the outside. You know, I'm in Paris today and London tomorrow. But, you know, after a couple of months, it gets old.
And one thing that happens is, and this is one of the few good things about the Great Flood, you know, Katrina, which is that a lot of musicians were displaced and they started doing gigs, especially in New York, and they got used to New York. Somebody like Kermit Ruffins, he really likes New York now. Mm-hmm. And Davell Crawford lives right up the street from me now, you know, 94th Street. He fell in love with New York. And so you do have more New Orleans musicians in New York now. Henry Butler, spectacular pianist, lives in New York now. Henry is blind, and he just told me it was easier for him in New York to get around, and you can hear him doing a lot of gigs in New York. Herlin Riley, the drummer, I'd like to talk just a bit about rhythmic, I guess you just call it rhythmic displacement in New Orleans. But but Herlin has kind of displaced himself. He spends half the time in New York. But when I was in New Orleans last week, he was playing in New Orleans with Jermaine Basel. So there is more of that now. You can hear more of it. And if you go to a site called nolafunk.com, they will give you a whole lot of information about New Orleans music in New York. And it's a pretty cool site.
Oh, that's a great resource. So if you're not yet ready to go to New Orleans, but you're in the New York area or you're going to find yourself in New York, definitely go to nolafunk.com.
You got it, right?
Yeah, oh yeah, yeah.
Good.
In fact, my first exposure to New Orleans music, I lived in San Francisco for almost 10 years, and there was a place on Geary called the Boom Boom Club, and there were just some young guys. This was in the 90s, and there were some young guys that came through. I don't know who they were, but what two things amazed me about them. One is they created this amazing party atmosphere, and two, they were unbelievable virtuosos. They're quoting Thelonious Monk. They're doing, you know, their musicality and their music, their chops were unbelievable, and yet the whole place was a party. And that was sort of preparation for me for when I finally got to New Orleans and realized, oh, there's a whole culture that's dedicated to this. Hey, let's disclose something about weather. I don't know about you, but once May starts rolling around, New Orleans is a little bit too much for me weather-wise. Now, some people have different tolerances for hot weather, but we should probably tell people that basically from around May till November,
yes,
it's one of the hottest places you'll ever be.
Yes. People just run from one air-conditioned place to the other.
And it's humid. And I remember I had a friend from Brazil who was a filmmaker, and she was going to Louisiana on a project in the summer. And when she came back, she says, that's the hottest I've ever been in my life.
Yeah.
So if you like – now, there are people that love hot, steamy weather. And if you do love hot, steamy weather, you will get it in abundance during those seasons. But on the flip side of that, it's a great place to spend the winter. The magnolia trees start blooming in February.
Yes.
It's just lovely weather. Now, you mentioned that
when I go every year, I go in January. And I've been doing that since 1990. And you never know what it's going to be. It can be 70 degrees one day, it can be 40 degrees another day. But it's always kind of moderate. And it's the beginning of Mardi Gras, so there's a little Mardi Gras buzz in the air, but it's not crowded with tourists at all yet. But there, mm-hmm. but it's starting up, and you can mm-hmm. kind of, you know, you can go to Twelfth Night. You can see it starting up, and all the groups that you'll hear, you know, at a spectacle like Thursdays at Jazz Fest, all the local groups, they're there all the time. So you can hear them, and there are not many tourists there in January, so you can go to all these clubs that I've been talking about, and then some, and just walk right in and have a great time. So that's my recommendation. And, of course, the city can always use a little business in January, so it's good for them as well.
Yeah, and I believe, and I forget the name of the holiday, but the carnival season really begins in January. I think on January 6th, it's Three Kings Day, or...
It's called Twelfth Night.
It's called Twelfth Night. Okay, and that's when
So
New Orleans has
a good time to go. It's a really good time to go to New Orleans, I think.
New Orleans has a million and one idiosyncratic traditions, and one of them is King's Cake.
Yes.
And so you know you'll see these mountains of King Cakes everywhere you go, starting around January 6th, Twelfth Night.
It's hilarious.
And you got to buy, you know, you buy one, and everyone's got to get one, and there's a lot of things like that in the city. Now you mentioned, I think before we started recording, that you bring students sometimes to New Orleans. Do you still do that?
Well, that's the origin of this book. I started bringing students. I became the director of the American Studies program here at Rider University, where I still teach, and I noticed colleagues bringing students to seeing some of the great canyons or some of the great museums. I mean, I thought, why not do a trip to New Orleans? Because I'd been going there a lot anyway, and that's how it all started up. And so I've been doing this trip since 1990, and it got me here every year, dependably. It's just a ritual. And that was very helpful to me because I could see the kind of the sense of discovery in my students, because they'd never seen anything like New Orleans before or heard anything like New Orleans music, just kind of experience that excitement, that kind of epiphany experience with them year after year and kind of see things through their eyes. And that's how I noticed so many things changing. And then Jason Marsalis actually told me, Jason is a great drummer, told me that he said, hey man, things really started changing about 1990. And I thought, oh, I actually blundered into something here. I guess it's right to start this book in 1990. And one thing I wanted to mention, because it's very important, is there's a kind of rhythmic tension where somebody will be a fraction of a second ahead of everybody else or a fraction behind everybody else. Like Jermaine Basil, who is like 80, oh my God, she's probably 85 years old now, is such a brilliant kind of push-ahead singer. You have to really push to keep up with her. Or the drummer Shannon Powell's the same way. And I heard a lot of musicians talk about this, that it's what gives New Orleans that kind of excitement and euphoria, which as John Batiste calls it, a euphoria that you just don't get anywhere else. And a lot of people told me that they think it comes from the whole parade tradition, where the person at the very front of the parade is going to be a fraction of a second different than the drummer at the back of the parade.
Oh,
and And I've heard musicians say, like Larry Seaberth, the pianist in New Orleans, I always go hear Larry Seaberth. He says when he goes to L.A., he always tries to get them to do that, but they just can't do it. They're so precise and so on top of the beat all the time that it's a little bit dull and a little bit mechanical. And that was a revelation to me. I knew there was something different about New Orleans rhythm, and apparently that's what it is.
Well, you know, taking this full circle, at the beginning of the call, I talked about the fact that Lester Young spent some of his formative years in New Orleans, and in his reminiscence of that time, he specifically said the parades. When he heard a parade, he dropped everything and he ran to be part of it. And that's where you would have heard. And if anybody's never been involved in one of these parades, it's exactly right. They're not stationary all together on a line. They are moving, and there's some guys in the back, and there's some guys in the front, and there's also the crowd, moving at different speeds. And of course, Lester Young was famous for or the way he played with time. And he is something he might have picked up as a young boy in the streets of New Orleans, as so many great musicians did. Mm-hmm. Well, the book, again, is New Orleans Remix. Listen, if you're a jazz fan, you've got to know New Orleans. And step one, I would say, is this book. This book will give you a glimmer of what you're missing. In fact, more than a glimmer. The chapter alone, on anybody who's an opera fan and a jazz fan, I don't know how many of us are there, but if you are, this book is absolutely a must. But if you're just trying to understand what's the big deal about New Orleans, if you're preparing for a trip to New Orleans, and I would even say if you've been to New Orleans, and this is another phenomenon, I've met so many people that, you know, they dipped into New Orleans for a couple of days, and I could put myself in that category because I actually did visit New Orleans in 90. I didn't get it. I was only there a couple of days. I didn't have any guidance, and I was like, what's the big deal? Well, the big deal is if you are knowledgeable and you can spend some time and you can go prepared, you can have a very profound musical, cultural, and I'm going to say spiritual experience in that most unique of American cities. And Jack Sullivan's covered it beautifully in the book New Orleans Remix. So, Jack, any parting words? Is there any way that people can sign up for your trip if they're not a student at Rider?
they can always email me at sullivanja@rider.edu. sullivanja@rider.edu. I also have a website. It's just jackrsullivan.com. And yes, we've had people come who were not students in the class, and a few musicians who came because I just wanted to sit in, because New Orleans is all about sitting in. And they had a great time, so absolutely.
Great, great. Well, thank you so much for the time. Thank you for adding this book. I know how hard it is to finish a book and get it between two covers. It is a big undertaking. And now all of us who love this music and love New Orleans and want to share it with other people have a great reference to a tool to help make that happen for more people. And I'll just leave us with this again. If you love jazz, figure out how you can get yourself to New Orleans. You will never regret it.
And just be careful, because as Alan Toussaint says, there are people there who came and loved it and said, I'm going to stay a little bit longer. And all of a sudden they looked around and said, hey, it's been 10 years now.
It's true. It's true. Well, thank you, Jack. And we'll talk soon again, I hope.
I hope so. Thank you so much.
We hope you enjoyed the podcast. If you did, please share it. That's how we grow. And remember to subscribe to jazzonthetube.com, the internet's largest collection of free, streamable, classic jazz videos.